You have to admit, that's the best beginning of a... Among the jokes that I've told, that's the best beginning. Brick is sitting on the beach, and geese fly overhead. They're flying south for the winter, and they look down, and they say, Brick, come fly with us. You know, join us. We're flying to paradise. And the Brick just lays back, puts his hands behind his head, takes out a cigar, and says, nah. That's the whole, it's hard to know when the joke is even over. that was by my own personal count, well, that was bottom two. Yeah. Bottom two so far, I would say. Okay. Okay. So before going on with the main content of today's lecture, I just wanted to finish up with a sort of final point from the previous two lectures. Okay, so, you know, the idea of the previous two lectures was to succinctly summarize the structure of differential geometry and then of general relativity. So last time, just to briefly restate, the basic things we were supposed to do were to see what the action for Einstein gravity is, so-called Einstein-Hilbert action, and we saw how to use the Palatini formalism, the Palatini approach to conveniently derive the equations of motion from the action, the Einstein equations. In the process, we got an important expression for T mu nu, the stress energy of whatever matter is present, as a certain variation of the matter action, okay, with respect to the, roughly speaking, the variation of the matter action with respect to the metric. And we met a couple of the most important forms of stress energy that we'll encounter in the class, basically the stress energy of a single scalar field, the sort of default thing that you model everything in cosmology with when you don't know what better to do. Yes? Yes. I mean, no, I would not mind. Thank you. Sorry. It begins so early. So soon. Yeah, no problem. Okay, so... And for point particles, for just a gas of point particles, moving along geodesics, and then we also met the perfect fluid stress energy tensor. Okay, and then our next task is to get to know all of the most important metrics. Both because they're all related to the, both because they relate in one way or another to the metric of greatest interest to us, the Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric, and just to sort of put the Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric in context. But before we do that, you know, having just summarized GR and differential geometry, it's worth pausing to take 10 or 15 minutes to compare the structure of that geometrical theory with another geometrical theory, Yang-Mills theory, which is sort of the other fundamental paradigm for what physical laws look like. Basically, all our matter theories are described by Yang-Mills theories, by gauge theories. Gravity is described by GR. So it's good to sort of attempt to quickly see there's a lot that's parallel about those two theories that's almost identical between them. And then, of course, there are some crucial differences. So we just want to take a few minutes to say what those are. In fact, I would like a new board to say what those are. And then we'll move on and talk about the coolest metrics. Okay, so let's maybe just try to summarize here and try to give two parallel accounts, Yang-Mills theory and GR. Okay, so what's the idea in Yang-Mills theory? So in GR, we had our manifold, and then we were interested in particular in above each point on the manifold, there was a vector space of interest, which was the tangent space to the manifold. It was really some sort of intrinsic vector space that is, in a sense, intrinsic to the manifold of tangent vectors. And if we took a vector in that vector space under a coordinate transformation, it transformed to some new, its components transformed to some new form. Okay, there was some transformation matrix, which I'll call W alpha beta, which performed some rotation, if you want, on the vector, on the components of the vector V, where in GR we know what W alpha beta actually is here. It's the derivative of the new coordinates with respect to the old coordinates. And you know, a crucial thing is that the difference between special relativity and general relativity is that in general relativity, this coordinate transformation is not rigid across the whole manifold. It can vary arbitrarily. This is some arbitrary coordinate transformation. So this matrix is different from one point to the next on the manifold. It's a function of the position on the manifold. So in gauge theory, the idea is similar, except now. So let's say we take SUN gauge theory, and so the idea might be that we have an n tuplet of n scalar fields, phi 1 through phi capital N. So here if this was an n dimensional manifold, little n dimensional manifold, this was an little n tuplet of components of the vector. Okay, here we still have a little n dimensional manifold. But then there's another n in the gain. There's capital N, the gauge group. So for example, just for concreteness, let's say we're talking about the gauge group is SUN. So this is a component with capital N. This is an n tuplet, capital N, scalar fields. Okay, let me just call this guy phi. And I'll use alpha for space-time indices, and I'll use Greek indices to denote space-time indices, and I'll use Latin indices like A to denote the components. The components of this n component object, of this capital N component object. In other words, over there, the vector space was the little n dimensional tangent space over each point in the manifold. Over here, which together, all the, you know, over every point, there's a little vector space. If you take, sort of roughly speaking, if you take the combination of all of those, if you take the combined object, of a vector space over each point, that's a so-called vector bundle over the manifold. So here we're talking about how the tangent spaces or the bundle of tangent spaces, the tangent bundle transforms. That's what we're talking about in GR. Here the vector space over a given point on the manifold has the vectors are these guys. They're vectors of n scalar fields. So we're talking about a different bundle. It's not the tangent bundle, it's the gauge bundle over the manifold. But apart from that, the same thing is true. We construct Yang-Mills theory by saying, okay, we have this vector of scalar fields, and we can take, now instead of taking an arbitrary coordinate transformation, W, we take an arbitrary unitary transformation from the group UN. Okay, just to make the parallelism completely clear here. So this goes to, so under an arbitrary gauge transformation now, the scalar fields get mixed up into one another according to this rule, where in GR, the key point, the matrix that did the mixing up was W, and the essential point was that W could depend on space-time. It was an arbitrary, could depend in an arbitrary way on the position of the manifold. On the position on the manifold. Similarly, in gauge theory, the essential point is that this is not a single matrix globally defined over the manifold. It too depends on the space-time position in an arbitrary way. I can choose a different matrix U, a different gauge, a different unitary matrix U at each point in space, and I'm supposed to be constructing a theory that is symmetric under that huge symmetry. Okay. So then what's the next step? Well, the next step is we have these scalar fields. We want to take derivatives of them. But just like what happened in GR, we discover that, alas, so this guy, now when we take the derivative of this guy, well, it still has only one Latin index. So we still think it should transform like a vector under gauge transformations, a contravariant vector, if you want. But that's not what happens. Okay, so imagine we make some gauge transformation. Well, the gauge transformation doesn't affect the partial derivative. It really has nothing to do with the partial derivative, so that doesn't change. But this guy, we're supposed to substitute this expression. And so then, now this partial acting on this guy will produce not one but two terms. There'll be the term that we want coming from the partial acting on this factor, but then there'll be the other term that we don't want coming from the partial acting on this factor. So in particular, we will not get the answer we want. It won't transform like a tensor. It will not transform like UAB d mu phi b. And of course, similar, we'd already discussed that there's an exactly analogous story over here. We tried to take a partial derivative of v, and it did not transform to what we would have wanted if this thing was a tensor with one index up and one index down. What we would have wanted was this. And that's not what we get. Okay, and so in both cases, the solution is to introduce a covariant derivative. So over here, we define some covariant derivative, which will act on this guy and as follows. And similarly over here, we introduce a covariant derivative, which will act on this guy. As follows. The whole point of this guy is that we've introduced this new connection where when we take the derivative in the mu direction, there are two indices here that make a little. These two indices for a fixed mu, these two indices make this thing a matrix, and that matrix performs a little rotation on this vector in the gauge bundle. And similarly, for a fixed direction mu in which we take the covariant derivative, these two indices form a little matrix which perform a little linear transformation on the tangent bundle. And we want to choose the transformation law for this guy. And for this guy, precisely so as to ensure that this thing, that these two objects do transform tensorially do transform as the appropriate type of tensor under a coordinate transformation or a gauge transformation. Okay, and so let's just see quickly. You know, on this side, life is a little bit simpler. So let's just only work out this side. But really, there's an exactly analogous story on that side, and we already know the answer. We already reviewed the answer on that side in the first lecture. But you know, let's just see what the story is here. So we want. Oh, you know, another thing is that I'll keep the index mu explicit. But it's kind of convenient to just suppress the Latin indices here and just use matrix notation. Just use ordinary, you know, matrix notation instead of showing all the indices explicitly. So in other words, I would just rewrite this guy. I would rewrite this equation as d mu acting on the vector phi is d mu plus a mu acting on the vector phi. By suppressed indices, is that clear? And it's small. Sorry. Okay, so I'll try to write a little bit bigger. Okay, so now what I want, so how does a mu have to transform? Well, what I want is that under a gauge transformation, so d and phi both transform to their gauge transformed quantities. And I want that, whatever that is, I want it to be equal to the same thing as if I had just performed the appropriate tensor transformation law on this guy. Now, this guy looks like it has two indices, mu and a. But I'm just performing a gauge transformation. I'm not performing any coordinate transformation at the moment, so the mu index is irrelevant. The mu index only knows about coordinate transformations. It's the a index. So this is just a vector. This object is just supposed to be a vector under gauge transformations with one index. So I want it to transform like this, like a vector would. And if I remember here that phi twiddle is by definition, phi twiddle is just u phi. So this side is really d mu twiddle u phi. If I just compare these two expressions, and they have to be true for any phi, I see that really d twiddle u has to be equal to u d. Those two operators have to be equal, since they have to be equal when they act on any vector. Okay, so that's just saying that the transformation law for d twiddle had better be u du inverse. So now if I just plug in explicitly what I mean by d. So d twiddle is d twiddle is partial plus a twiddle, and this guy is u partial plus a u inverse. So what happens here? So this is an operator and this is an operator. So imagine this is acting on some field phi here and here. So we have two terms here. When the u partial u inverse term acts on a field phi, the partial has two things to act on. So it can either act on the u inverse that lies to the right of it, or it can act on the field phi. The term where it passes through, where the partial mu passes through the u inverse and acts on phi, that term just becomes u inverse partial mu phi. But that's just partial mu phi. So that's just that term just reduces to partial mu, and cancels on this term. So the So the terms that remain over here are the term where we have u, and then d mu acts on this u, not on phi. And then we have the other term u a u inverse. Okay, so in other words, if I think of those two guys as operators, this is just saying that this term cancels against one of the terms on the other side, and I'm left with and that's too small. I'm making a terrible noise that is driving. Can other people see? I've never been sensitive to this like squeaking of chalk, but like my collaborator Shane, no one. I didn't make anyone cringe just then. You guys are all okay. I can keep using this chalk. I've seen people. It's like dogs can hear things that. Anyway. Okay, so we get, you know, we by demanding that the covariant derivative of a tensor in the gauge bundle be a tensor itself, we get this transformation law for how A has to transform, and the exactly analogous calculation on this side gives us a transformation law for how gamma transforms. Which is exactly the guy that we already reviewed in the previous lecture. Okay, so far they are essentially the same. I mean, the only so far the two tracks are essentially the same. You know, the only real difference so far is that this A has this connection on this side has three indices, and the index corresponding to the direction of the derivative is really of a distinct type from the other two indices that perform the rotation in the bundle over the manifold. And here, you know, it turns out to be crucial that all three indices are really of the same type, that they're not distinguished from one another in the same way. Okay, so why is that? Well, so let's now proceed to ask, you know, how do we do physics with this? So we've constructed things that transform tensorially. Our ultimate goal is to write down an actual scalar quantity that depends on these connections, and so could describe their dynamics, could describe the equations of motion that they obey or the quantum mechanics that they obey. Does anyone have any questions, by the way? So remember what we did on this. Remember what we did on this side when we wanted to get a tensor. You know, gamma. We want to construct a scalar that depends on this guy, so it can describe its physics, can describe its dynamical laws. But this guy by itself does not transform like a tensor. We just went to all this trouble to make sure that the covariant derivative transform tensorially, but the result was that this guy does not transform like a tensor. So to get a tensor, to build a tensor out of this guy, we used the Ricci identity. We took the failure to commute of partial derivatives, of covariant derivatives, I mean. So acting on some vector v. Okay, we took this definition. Now this thing, the Riemann curvature that we get, does transform like a tensor, and because of this equation, it's given by some particular formula, which you remember has sort of two terms that are linear in gamma but differentiated, and two terms that are quadratic. There's a gamma differentiated minus a gamma differentiated plus a gamma squared term minus a gamma squared term. So we just do the same thing over here. So again, the way if we want to get an actual tensor that depends on A, we use exactly the same trick. We look at the failure of commutativity. We take the Ricci identity again of two gauge covariant derivatives D acting on a scalar field phi. That was the curvature of the tangent bundle. This guy is the curvature of the gauge bundle. Okay, so okay, but the curvature of the gauge bundle is nothing but F mu nu, the gauge field strength. Okay, if we just suppress these two gauge indices and only look at the spacetime indices, this guy if we plug in this expression that capital D, the gauge covariant derivative is partial plus A, and evaluate this expression, we just find that F mu nu is given by partial mu A nu minus partial nu A mu plus the commutator of A mu and A nu. Okay, where again, in this formula, I am suppressing these just like I was before. This is really a matrix with row and column labeled by these two gauge indices A, B. And each of these A's are really matrices. They have row and column indices A, B. And when I take the product here, you know, maybe it'll be helpful to just put the actual indices in here. Just to be clear, so this expression is just another way of writing F A B mu nu is equal to D mu A nu A B minus D nu A mu. Can you guys see the step at the bottom here? A B, and then so this is A mu A nu minus A nu A mu. Let me just write the A mu A nu part. So A mu A C A nu C B. Okay, and then minus the same thing, but with mu and nu swap. Okay. So in the same way that we were led to introduce the connection on the tangent bundle and have it take a certain non-tensorial transformation law, but then we wanted to build a tensor out of it, so we took the Ricci identity to define the curvature, and we got a formula for the curvature, which, again, if I suppressed these, if I again treated these two indices, alpha and beta, as matrix indices, this formula that you guys derived in the last tutorial is looks exactly like that normal Yang-Mills formula. It says, so if I just keep these indices and just suppress these guys, it says that R mu nu is equal to partial mu gamma nu minus partial nu gamma mu plus gamma mu gamma nu. Okay. So everything so far is really strictly parallel. Now maybe the last point. Is just that it's really at this last step that a important difference appears. That okay, so on both sides I have tensors that are tantalizingly close to, I just need to contract up their indices to get a scalar to be my action. Well, on this side, this tensor has four indices, but you know I can do the usual thing. With that, I can since all of these indices are of the same type, I can contract them with one another. In particular, I can contract alpha with mu to get the Ricci tensor r beta nu. And then I can, so in other words, I can contract alpha with mu, and I can contract beta with nu. To get the Ricci scalar, I can build a scalar out of that is just linear in the curvature. So that's the simplest thing I can build. So that's what I write down. That's what I'll take my action to be. It's just that scalar curvature with an appropriate dimensionful constant to make the Lagrangian have the right units. And I integrate that over the manifold. I can't do the same trick here because here, this quantity that we constructed, that's the exact analog of the Riemann tensor. If I wanted to construct an analog of the Ricci tensor here, I would meet an obstruction because the Ricci tensor is constructed by contracting the up index over there with one of these last two indices here. I can't do that here because they're of different. They just lie in different vector spaces. So I can't contract those guys. The best I can do is write down two copies of f. If I want to contract up the indices, the best thing I can do is contract this guy with this guy, and this guy with this guy, and this guy with this guy. This guy with this guy. In other words, I just multiply this guy by, contract it with delta BC, delta AD, G, mu rho, G, mu sigma. That's nothing but, now if you think about it, that's nothing but these two G's just raise these rows and sigmas and make them an upper mu nu, and then these deltas really just say, take this matrix and this matrix, multiply them as matrices, and then take the trace. So this is really just trace of f mu nu, f mu nu. That's the simplest scalar I can construct on the gauge side. And so that's the action that I take. I take minus 1/4 of this, and that's the action for Yang-Mills theory. So I think that's basically all I wanted to say, that they have these two structures that are very parallel to one another. The connection in gauge theory is nothing but the exact analog of the Christoffel symbol in GR. The field strength tensor in Yang-Mills theory is nothing but the exact analog of the Riemann tensor in GR. But then the fact that the Riemann tensor, all its indices are of the same sort, whereas on the gauge field side, the field strength tensor has two different sorts of indices. That ultimately is crucial. That means that the actual action we write down in one case is very different from the action we write down in the other case, behaves completely differently from a physics standpoint. Anyway, just thought it was worth mentioning that before leaving the general review topic. Okay, but I took longer than I intended. Let me move on now to discuss. So there are new lecture notes for today's lecture, for today and tomorrow's lecture. Are those up on the wiki now?
Yeah, but I also brought in copies.
Oh, okay. So their copies are. Oh, they've been passed around or something. Okay. So what are the basic types of what are the basic metrics that we want to meet? There are three. These are by far the most important metrics in physics. They're the maximally symmetric metrics, the maximally symmetric manifolds. Okay, so these include Euclidean space, n-dimensional Euclidean space, n-dimensional Minkowski space. the n-dimensional sphere, n-dimensional De Sitter space, the n-dimensional negatively curved hyperboloid, and the n-dimensional anti-De Sitter space. So those spaces really just turn up all over the place in physics. It's good to, they're all very important, and you'll see them a million times. You know, the key point here is that they're really almost trivially related to one another. So I just want to show you that there's a single sort of elegant construction that constructs all these spaces at once, and you see that they're really just, you know, only differ from one another by little sign flips here and there. And the construction is also nice because it gives a nice way to just visualize all of these spaces in one go. Okay, then cosmological spacetimes. It's an observational fact at this point that the universe that we live in, for all epochs that we can observe, appears to be extremely well approximated by a so-called Friedman-Robertson-Walker spacetime, which, in short, is just a spacetime where every three-dimensional spatial slice of the spacetime is one of these maximally symmetric spaces, but then they can stretch or contract in an arbitrary way as time evolves. So the spatial slices are maximally symmetric, but there's no particular symmetry in the time direction, and so those slices stretch and contract. And then finally, the black hole metrics. Non-spinning black hole is Schwarzschild. And spinning black hole is Kerr. And this is one of those unusual situations where usually in physics, like, the more symmetrical things are the more beautiful ones. But here the least symmetrical guy on the board here is this Kerr metric for a spinning black hole. But it's, like, by far the most beautiful metric anyone has ever found. So it's like just anyway. I don't know why. I'm trying to motivate. You could take a negative view that we're starting with the awesomest spacetimes, and then he's sucking the symmetry out of them. I'm losing heart, losing. But that's not how you should feel. You should feel like we're working towards the ultimate spacetime, the Kerr spacetime. Okay. So what is the construction? Let's just do this construction of these spacetimes. Well, so as a warm up, let's just do the sphere. How do we? You know, what's the usual way that you construct the n-dimensional sphere? Well, you construct the two-dimensional sphere. When you imagine it in your head, you imagine it embedded in a flat three-dimensional spacetime. And you know, so more generally, when we want to construct the n-dimensional sphere, we do it by embedding it in an n plus one dimensional spacetime. So let me use the notation where xa with a capital letter index, capital letter indices run from 1 to n plus 1. Okay, so they run over the dimension of the embedding space, whereas lowercase Latin indices, coordinates with lowercase Latin indices are coordinates on the n-dimensional space of interest. So they only run from 1 to n, the actual dimension of the manifold we're trying to produce. Okay, so how do we produce the n-sphere? Well, we start with an n plus one dimensional embedding space that just has that is flat n plus one dimensional Euclidean space. So its metric, its line element, I should say, is just given by the Kronecker delta AB times dxA dxB. And so we can just split that into this. So this is just dx1 squared plus dx2 squared plus up to dxn plus 1 squared. So we can split that into the first n terms and the final n plus 1th term. Okay, so we can write it as d little ab x little a, sorry, dx little b, and then plus the extra term we left off. Okay, so that's the metric on the embedding space. And now we just consider a surface. We consider a surface defined by one equation, so that since it's defined by just one equation, instead of being an n plus one dimensional surface, now the surface that satisfies that equation will only be n dimensional. Okay, so we take the surface to be, we choose some constant rho, the radius of the sphere, and we take the surface to be, you know, this one. Or in other words, again, we can split things up. Okay. And now, to obtain the metric on the n-dimensional sphere, right? That's what we're trying to do here. We start with the metric in the embedding space, the n plus one dimensional metric. This the line element in the n plus one dimensional space, and we want to say what is the induced metric on the sphere. So in other words, you know, we have some space here, and we put our sphere in there, and because it's embedded in a larger space that already has a metric on it, there's an induced metric on this surface. So if I ask, you know, what is the metric on the n-sphere? What is the distance between two infinitesimally neighboring points? The induced metric says that it's nothing but the same distance as I would get if I imagined going between those two points in the ambient embedding space. Okay? So in other words, if I want to just write down explicitly what that means, these erasers are very good. Very good erasers. But I want to say explicitly what that means. You know, I can just eliminate the n plus 1th coordinate here. So I can just solve for x n plus 1 in this expression. Okay, and so it's and then I can just take the differential of both sides and use to get, okay, so I take the differential of this side to get d x n plus 1 is equal to plus or minus 1 half rho squared . Okay, so that's the differential, and if I just plug that in to eliminate the n plus 1th coordinate in the metric, it's a simple exercise to show that the metric now takes on the form that same line element just becomes after I substitute in this expression. Okay, where I have simplified my life by introducing two bits of notation here, okay, defining two bits of notation, I have defined x squared to be the n-dimensional contraction with the n-dimensional flat metric, delta AB, of x with itself. And I have defined x with a lower index here and here to have its index lowered again with this flat n dimensional metric. Okay, so this is the metric for the n sphere. And you know, you can just check in some of the lower dimensional cases, it's good to just check that this gets back the answers that you're used to. So for example, in the case of the one sphere, the circle, you know, what have we done? We've constructed the circle by looking at the locus of points that are a distance rho from the origin in two-dimensional Euclidean space. And then we've eliminated the x2 coordinate in favor of the x1 coordinate. So we have this expression here where for the one sphere, xa only runs over one value. And to put that in normal coordinates, we would just take, put that in familiar coordinates, we would just take that x1 coordinate to be, you know, rho cosine theta. And if you just do that, if you just plug that into that metric, you'll find the familiar line element for the circle. For the circle of radius rho, you'll find that expression over there just reduces to ds squared is equal to rho squared d theta squared. Okay, so in other words, as you move a little angle d theta around the circle, you've moved a distance rho d theta, and this is just that expression squared. Or in the three-dimensional case, and that for the two-sphere, we embed the two-sphere in a three-dimensional Euclidean space, where we have our x1 coordinate and our x2 coordinate, and then we eliminate the x3 coordinate, and we get this resulting metric that only depends on x1 and x2. But if you want to put that in a normal familiar form, you would replace x1 and x2 by their spherical coordinates. So their spherical coordinates are rho sine theta cosine phi, and x2 is rho sine theta sine phi. Okay, and again, if you just plug that into that expression, you'll get the more familiar metric for the two-sphere. Okay, so that's just warm up, because now the general construction is just really just a trivial modification of this. You didn't think the brick was funny. I think of the brick as, I mean, that could be you or me. Someone flies by, and you're like, nah, I'll just, no? It doesn't strike a chord deep within you? No? Oh, well. Okay. So we're going to do the exactly parallel construction now. Now suppose that instead of producing the sphere, which is a surface that has positive curvature, and purely spatial directions, I want to produce an n-dimensional manifold, the maximally symmetric manifold with signature p comma q. So in other words, p spatial directions and q time directions, and I want curvature that can be positive, zero, or negative, okay, corresponding to this discrete variable k being plus 1, 0, or minus 1. And I want its radius of curvature, again, to be rho, just like rho was the radius of the sphere that we constructed in the sort of model case. Okay, then the only things we change are the following. We again take a flat n-dimensional embedding space, but now instead of So whereas previously we wrote ds squared was equal to delta AB XA, XB, plus, sorry, delta AB, DXA, DXB, plus DXN plus 1 squared. In other words, that expression in the middle up there. So now we just insert a k corresponding to the curvature that we want to get. And we insert, instead of delta AB, we insert the flat metric eta AB, but with signature P comma Q, with the signature that we want to get at the end of the day. OK, so in other words, eta AB P comma Q is the metric with P plus ones and then Q minus ones. Yep.
Why just put the Q there?
So, you know, I'm telling you the neat way to do it, and then when we, and then it's a bit hard to, you know, really you get the maximally symmetric spaces by embedding. You can get a maximally symmetric space. You get a maximally symmetric space anytime you embed a quadratically defined surface in an ambient flat space. But you can take the coefficients to have arbitrary sign to be an arbitrary combination of signs in the quadratic equation, and you can take the embedding space to have an arbitrary combination of signs. So then you actually work through and ask, well, what space do I get at the end of the day? You calculate and you find that it is the one with, it has a certain signature and a certain curvature. So just for convenience, I'm now going back and writing it in the notation that makes that clear from the outset. But I guess it would be hard to guess from the outset. I'm not sure I have a obvious answer for why at the start you would write it in this notation. This is kind of retroactively going back and making the notation nice, putting it in a memorable form, basically. Okay, and so similarly, and now we take the embedding equation to be exactly the same. Okay, and then we just follow the same process. We solve this equation for xn plus 1, take its differential, use that differential expression to eliminate the dxn plus 1 term from the metric up here, to convert it from an n plus 1 dimensional line element to the induced n dimensional line element on the surface defined by this equation. And we find, instead of this expression, we find a similar expression where, again, for notational convenience, I've defined these same expressions, but with eta pq replacing delta here. So in other words, in this expression, x squared is eta ab pq xa xb. And when I lower an index, what I mean is that I've lowered it with the n-dimensional flat metric. Okay? Okay, so this is now the metric for every maximally symmetric space. So let's just make a little table of what we're talking about. Okay, so these guys all have. So let's make a table with k on this axis. So k equals plus 1, 0, and minus 1. And the signature on this axis. So if we have a purely spatial metric, its signature is n, 0. Or if we have a space-time with one time direction, its signature is n minus 1, 1. And all of these guys are famous spaces. Okay, the positively curved purely spatial guy, that's the n-dimensional sphere, Sn, the positively curved. So if we look at the purely spatial guys in the top row, the positively curved guy is the sphere. The uncurved guy is just ordinary Euclidean space, n-dimensional Euclidean space. And the negatively curved guy is the n-dimensional hyperboloid. And then if we go to the corresponding space times with one time direction, this guy is n-dimensional de Sitter space, this guy is n-dimensional Minkowski space, and this guy is n-dimensional ADS space. And let's just use this construction to draw a picture of some of these spaces. Okay, so if we look at the embedding space, if we look at the signature of the embedding space, if we go through this table, the guys, okay, we don't need a picture of Euclidean space or Minkowski space. You guys already know what that looks like. The only guy that is embedded in purely positive signature, so where the embedding space has all plus signs, is this guy. Okay, and of course you know what he looks like. These two guys, if you have a negatively curved space with purely positive signature, or positively curved space with one time direction, both of those. The embedding space has one time direction. Okay, so let's draw the flat embedding space with one time direction. And so it has one time direction, so it has a light cone that looks the normal way. And in this context, ooh, colored chalk. Hey, did you guys have Mark Wise, and did he say, like, ooh, colored chalk, I love colored chalk? Did he say that? Because I once upon a time took quantum field theory from him, and he said that a lot, and I thought it was hilarious. Every time he talked about colored chalk, I was delighted. Anyway, but you can see my standards for humor are lower than yours, so I can understand if this tough audience did not think that was funny. I'm just joking. So the hyperboloid here, if you look at the embedding equation for the hyperboloid, you know what? I made an error here. This embedding equation should also have a k on this side. Sorry about that. So if you look at the hyperboloid case where k is minus 1, and this guy is a purely positive signature metric, if you just ask what does that surface look like in this space, it's the surface like this. It asymptotes to the light cone from the inside. Okay. Whereas de Sitter space, the other option, if you look at the embedding, if you just think about what this embedding equation is saying, with k positive, and this being a metric with one negative direction in it, that's the surface that embeds that's the surface that asymptotes to the light cone from the outside. Okay, so it's kind of an hourglass shape.
And this point of minimum approach is rho, the radius of curvature of the hyperboloid. And this point of minimum approach here is rho, the De Sitter radius. Okay, and so yeah, De Sitter space is basically a sphere that contracts to a minimum radius rho and then re-expands out to infinity again. And then finally, the final guy we want to draw is ADS space. So there, the embedding space has two time directions. And so let me suggest that we draw one of the time directions this way and the other time direction coming out of the board, and then we'll use the other direction in the board as a space direction. So since there's only one space direction and two time directions, the light cones, you know, look like this. And you can convince yourself that what that embedding equation is saying is that anti-De Sitter space is the space that asymptotes to those light cones like this. Usually you don't go beyond this line in the table because then you have two time directions. And the problem with two time directions is that, you know, if this is a time direction and this is a time direction, then according to the usual laws of physics, I'm allowed to, my geodesics, you know, if I fire a rocket, I can go anywhere as long as it's in a time-like direction. And so I can, you know, my grandmother could have been firing a rocket here, and then she could be getting old, and she could give it to me at some point around here, and then I would continue firing the rocket, and then I would get back here, and I would be like, oh, look at this nice lady. You know, what's your name? And I'd be like, oh, that's my grandmother's name. Weird. And then I'd be like, wait a minute. So that's the reason why usually we don't consider this row on the table. Although some people do consider this row on the table. Actually, there's some quite sensible stuff that's done. But naively, two time directions is bad for that reason. So anyway, okay, so we only got through the maximally symmetric metrics. I should stop now, but next time we'll do Friedman, Robertson, Walker, and the black holes. They just have a-